This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit.
And good afternoon. Welcome to another edition of Crest in the Afternoon. This is, again, Bryant Shanley, Al Crest is executive producer. Hoping you're all having an enjoyable 4th of July weekend. Got another great 2 hours coming up talking about the things that matter most. We'll be talking with Dr. Greg Popchak, who's doing a social science apologetic series on the effects of cohabitation. There's a lot of data recently that shows that divorce rates are declining, but that's not necessarily for a good reason. According to Census Bureau data, the percentage of cohabitating adults ages 25 to 34 has increased. A decade ago, it was at 12%. Now it's at 15%. While the percentage of those same age 25 to 34-year-olds who are married is continuing to decline, 59% of 25 to 34-year-olds were married in 1978, and that's gone down to about 30% today. There's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the things we're going to be looking at within that data is what that says about cohabitation and the effects of cohabitation on marriage. So that's coming up right after the news. And then also in this hour, continuing on our theme of things related to the founding of America, we're going to be looking at Catholicism and the American founding. This is with Dr. Brad Berzer, who's the Russell Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College. As we've discussed in the past, the early days of America were a time of anti-Catholicism. Catholics played little direct role in the founding of America, but they did play a role, and there were some important factors. At that time, America was only about 1% Catholic, but we had, like I said, influences such as Charles Carroll, who was very wealthy, very well-respected man by the early founders. And what effect did he have on the early days of America? And then also, as America began to shift towards more explicit anti-Catholicism over the next several decades, how did Catholics live in that world and react in that world? So all that's coming up with Dr. Brad Berzer. And in the second hour, always a favorite, Abbot Jeremy Driscoll, looking at what happens at Mass. But first, let's get to the news.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, July 5th. It's the Feast of St. Anthony Maria Zachariah. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, serving pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. President Trump says he's considering an executive order to make sure a citizenship question is included on the 2020 census.
We're thinking about doing that. It's one of the ways. We have four or five ways we can do it. It's one of the ways that we're thinking about doing it very seriously. We're doing well in the census.
The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 last week to block the citizenship question from appearing on the upcoming census. Trump said Justice Roberts essentially left the door open for the High Court to revisit the issue in the future. The 2 p.m. deadline, though, has come and gone for how the Department of Justice lawyers to explain how the Trump administration will proceed with trying to put the citizenship question on the 2020 census. One person is dead and a manhunt is underway after a shooting at a South Carolina Walmart. The shooting was reported around 1:30 p.m. local time in Greenville County, which is just southwest of Charlotte. Police say the incident is being treated as an active shooter situation and that a manhunt for the suspect is currently taking place. Witnesses reported the shooting happened near the pharmacy area inside the store. Southern California is still on edge. A magnitude 5.4 aftershock hit just after 4 a.m. today near the town of Ridgecrest. That's near the center of the powerful 6.4 quake that rattled the area on the 4th of July, the strongest earthquake to hit the region in about two decades. Steps are being taken to preserve a 1,600-year-old mosaic depicting a scene from the Book of Exodus. The mosaic showing the story of Elam in Exodus 15:27 was found at the site of a 5th-century synagogue in the ancient village of Hukok in the Lower Galilee. Elam is where the Israelites camped after leaving Egypt and wandering in the desert without water. Scholars say the mosaic is especially interesting as Elam is considered a minor episode in the Israelites' desert wanderings. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Divorce rates are declining. And you always want to know why is that the case? Well, the Census Bureau reports that the percentage of cohabiting adults ages 25 to 34 increased from 12% a decade ago to 15% in 2018, while the percentage of 25 to 34-year-olds who are married continues to decline. Joining me right now to talk about cohabitation is Dr. Greg Popchak, chair of the online Master of Pastoral Studies program at Holy Apostles College and Seminary. He's also executive director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute and the author of more than a dozen books. You hear his wife, Lisa, and Greg co-hosting More to Life every day on Ave Maria Radio. Hey, Greg, how are you?
Doing well, Al. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk about cohabitation in marriage, the relationship between the two. I don't know what the recent data shows, but it used to be thought that those who cohabit before marriage have less success in sustaining their marriage. Does that is that still true?
That generally does continue to hold up.
Okay.
In fact, couples who cohabit, not necessarily with each other, but who have a history of cohabitation, are about 150% more likely to get divorced than couples who did not cohabit before they got married, either in a path to, you know, cohabit with a present partner or a past partner.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say, yeah.
Sure. Well, then we do see divorce rates declining now.
Right, and right. Which sounds like a good thing.
It sure does, yeah.
But so, also, fewer, but it's because fewer people are getting married.
Gotcha. Right, right. So the pool of married people is shrinking, which
right.
means, of course, the number of people divorcing will shrink.
Well, because the people who actually choose marriage then value it more. Right,
mm-hmm.
And so the people who do marry are going to be more likely to stay married because they value marriage in the first place.
That's right.
But the reality is, fewer people are getting married. In fact, you know, the study that we're talking about today found that in 1978, 59% of 24 to 34 year olds were married, but now only 30% of 25 to 34 year olds are married. So we're talking about a decrease of almost 30%.
Wow. Hmm. What's the common rationale? I mean, I could fill in the blanks, but what do we actually find about the reasons people choose cohabitation rather than marriage?
Well, it's sort of twofold. One is that people really do see cohabitation, despite all the research that says this is not true. They see it as a step toward marriage. Couples are getting more serious now, and so we're going to commit to each other. In fact, what we're seeing in this study, in particular from the Institute of Family Studies, they found that shotgun cohabitations are quickly overtaking shotgun marriages. That when a couple gets pregnant, they decide that the way to show that they're serious about each other is not to marry,
okay.
but rather to cohabit. And that, you know, that of course causes all kinds of problems down the road. But the reality is, most of society sees cohabitation as a natural stepping stone toward marriage, despite what the research says about it. Now, the other factor, I think, is that because divorce has become so common and accepted, people have a difficult time sometimes determining the difference between marriage and cohabitation, because marriages are so easily
yes,
unmade today.
Yes, right? That's right.
So why should we go through all the hassle of marriage if there's no greater likelihood that we're going to make this work than if we were just moving in together? So psychologically, the distinction between marriage and cohabiting has really been obliterated by, like, no-fault divorce.
Hmm. Okay, so the rationale then is, on the one hand, it's almost, I'm going to buy the car, so I ought to drive it first. So there's a kind of consumer approach to this. I want to test out the product before I actually sign on the dotted line. There's kind of a contractual understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Yes, yeah, that's true. That's
okay.
The first part of it, yeah.
Yeah, and then the second part is, what's the big deal, anyways? People get divorced so easily. So, listen, why don't we just cohabit for a while? If it works out, we'll get married. Marriage isn't that big a deal in the first place.
Well, and it's expensive, right? I mean, because we've now piled all kinds of
right.
cultural rituals onto marriage. So the average wedding is running $40,000 these days. And, you know, so why do we want to put ourselves through that if we can't guarantee that marriage is going to be any more stable, successful, or happy than cohabitation, which is a whole lot cheaper?
Yeah.
It's like the world's vision of the generic, literally, the black and white box relationship.
Okay, but marriage and cohabitation do have different outcomes, right?
Yes.
In terms of marital satisfaction or
very
relationship satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's satisfaction, commitment, and stability, all
okay.
three of those things. And that's what this study found. This is a brand-new study from the Institute for Family Studies. Looked at the level of satisfaction, commitment, and stability that cohabiting couples experience versus married couples to see, is there really a difference between these two relationship products, if you will? If the world says, no, they're really the same, it's just that marriage comes with a higher price tag because of all the stuff we got to add to it, you know, then is that really true even today? And what they're finding is that, yeah, actually marriage has something about it that increases the satisfaction, the commitment, and the stability of married relationships in comparison with cohabiting relationships.
Mm-hmm. So they report greater satisfaction in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They have higher degrees of commitment.
Right.
Married couples have higher degrees of commitment. And
significantly higher stability as well. And the difference between commitment and stability...
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the difference was there.
Yeah, so commitment has to do with the value one places on the relationship and the desire that it would continue. Whereas stability refers to the couple's prediction that it's likely to continue.
The fact, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So sort of
intentionally... Wait, the fact of it continuing...
The likelihood that it will, like the couple's perception that we want this to continue, right? As opposed to we're going to make this continue versus we just value the relationship and we wish it would.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's actually the highest one of the differences between married couples and cohabiting couples. Married couples were 12% more likely to be satisfied with their relationship. So and the majority of those who reported they were more satisfied in marriage said that they were very happy in the relationship versus cohabiting couples.
Okay.
15% of married couples were 15% more likely to be committed to the relationship. That means, again, they valued the relationship and they wanted it to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And then 26% of married couples... married couples experienced 26% more stability. In other words, they said that their relationship was more likely to last, and that they were working hard to make it last, as opposed to cohabiting couples.
So the vow makes a difference.
It does. It does, and actually, it's consistent with Scott Stanley's work. He's a sociologist who coined the phrase "sliding versus deciding." For marriage, the traditional path was deciding for marriage.
Right.
We would date, and then we would make a public commitment to sort of increase our commitment and decrease our choices by quote unquote maybe going steady or some public sign that we're exclusive now, and then we would make a public commitment through engagement, and then we would make another public commitment in marriage, and each time we would make a conscious decision to increase our commitment and decrease our options, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the traditional deciding path to marriage.
Right, right.
And it involves that public commitment. That's sort of the key. The current path to marriage, Scott Stanley says, is more of a sliding path where we start to date and then we start to sleep together and then, maybe you have, a couple pairs of socks or underwear in my drawer and then, you have your wardrobe is in my closet and then, since all my stuff's over there anyway, I might as well move in. And then, we have a kid or two, and, people are starting to give us the hairy eyeballs, so I guess we should just get married. And that's the first time they actually make a public commitment to anything. Up until that point, they've really slid into the relationship, and life has just carried them along. Now the couple makes a public commitment, and they wake up, and they say, oh, my gosh, you know what? I never really chose any of this. How did I end up here?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a crisis, then, that happens at that point that the traditional couples don't experience. And so, as you say, the vow matters. Because it's not just a piece of paper, it's an actual public promise that I am choosing this as opposed to mindlessly just going along with wherever life is carrying me.
I remember when cohabitation became, I don't want to say acceptable, but it started to become more frequent. In other words, parents would have to deal with this. They would have to all of a sudden have a daughter or a son who ended up living with their partner, and they were postponing marriage. And there was still a stigma attached to it. This is back in the 1960s and early 70s.
Sure.
Now it seems as though the stigma has just about entirely disappeared in general society.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's 75%. Of people believe that raising kids in a cohabiting relationship is perfectly fine.
Yeah. What do kids think?
Not they don't think the same thing. The reality is, well, I mean, you know, of course, you know, kids always love their parents, but I mean, but right. the reality right. for children in cohabiting couples is much, much worse. They are at much higher risk of poverty. They're at much higher risk of physical and sexual abuse. They're much higher risk of being raised in single-parent households because cohabiting relationships are so much less stable. The reality is all the numbers for kids raised in cohabiting households are so much worse than kids raised in married households, even if there's some conflict in that marriage. Kids do better in when they're raised with their natural mother and father.
With the numbers all going against the choice to cohabit, why do people persist in cohabiting? Does everybody think that I can avoid the downside of this? You know, the love has its reasons beyond the mind. You know, I mean, I think I can escape any of these problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there are lots of rationalizations. I mean, the reality is ideology always trumps reality when we make life choices.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we can see a list of facts and say it's true for somebody, but we can rationalize that it's not really true for me for whatever reason.
Right.
And when the culture doesn't support it, when the cultural values don't support it, then there's a loss of motivation for me to personally choose the more expensive thing. And I don't just mean with a price tag on it, dollar signs. I mean emotionally and relationally more expensive to commit consciously to something than just to go along.
Yeah. Greg, how do people stay in touch with you?
CatholicCounselors.com.
CatholicCounselors.com. Dr. Gregory Popcheck, thanks. We'll talk again. This is troubling. It's hard to know where a society ends up that decides marriage isn't important. We'll have to talk about that again. Thanks, Greg.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
You'll hear Jewish convert Mark Nargebauer offer some of his testimony and teach the ladies of Heart to Heart about the Jewish background of Catholicism on our next program.
But I met these believers in Jesus who were Jewish in the synagogue, and they had this most amazing testimony of love and faith. I said, "What is it about you guys?" I thought maybe they were Buddhist or Hindu or something that made them with a peace consciousness. They said, "We believe in Jesus." I said, "Jesus, how could you? Buddha, maybe. Muhammad, all right. Well, maybe not. But Jesus, how could you?"
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Mark Neugebauer and his wife, Sue, are Messianic Jewish Catholics residing in Toronto. They spoke about the rich treasure of our Catholic faith through the liturgy, history, culture, and worship we've inherited from our Jewish brothers and sisters. Hear more on Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Now, on the Ave Maria Radio app, the prayer section, where you can listen to the Holy Rosary. All four mysteries are voiced by Christ as the Answer and Father Knows Best host, Father John Ricardo. Are you struggling to remember specific prayers for pre- and post-confession, reciting the Stations of the Cross, or prayers during Eucharistic Adoration? It's all there, word for word, and within a few clicks, under the prayer section, on the Ave Maria Radio app. Download it on your smart device today.
Fire on the Earth, Peter Herbeck.
Jesus said, "If you're going to follow me, the world's going to hate you because it hated me first." Friends, you know, we're living at a time when the world is getting more and more offended by God, by the teaching of Jesus, by Jesus' understanding of reality, by the church's teaching about all kinds of things, about what's a man, what's a woman, what's a family, when does life begin, who has the power to take life, who doesn't, all this stuff. Society is celebrating things that Jesus condemns, and society is getting angry at the church. Who do you think you are? You're intolerant, hateful people. And look what else is happening. As it gets hotter, as the heat gets turned up, quite a few Catholics are drifting with the culture because they don't want to take the heat. And we're losing an amazing opportunity to stand with Jesus right now. It's really foolish. It's so unwise. And if we don't see it, we're going to miss the most important things Jesus wants us to do. And we're going to have to appear before the judgment seat of God on it. That's important. Trust in the Lord. Don't be afraid. If men reject you because what you believe they deem is hateful, blessed are you. Peter says, rejoice. Don't run from it. Rejoice in it.
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Hey, good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. And there's no doubt that American Catholics have had extraordinary respect for the American experiment, the American proposition, and respect for the American founders, the founding fathers. At the same time, it is kind of odd, because there's no doubt that the American founding had a deep streak of anti-Catholicism that ran through it. And so it's interesting to try to sort out Catholicism then in the American founding and Catholics today as they reflect back upon a nation that they love, but which also has as part of its history and even part of its founding a disdain for the Catholic Church. With me to talk about Catholicism and the American founding is Dr. Brad Berzer. He is Russell Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College, the author of several books, including Russell Kirk, American Conservative. Well, Brad, good to have you with me. Thank you.
Al, thank you. It's only been a few weeks, and what a treasure for me. That's
well,
great. Thank you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. This is a story that I'm very interested in. There's no doubt that Catholics were important in helping to found the continent and develop it, because you had Franciscan and Jesuit missionaries all around. And of course, we had the Catholic involvement in the state of Maryland. But overall, Catholicism wasn't held in high regard by the movers and shakers of the colonists.
No, that's right, Al. In fact, to the point where it's almost absurd, they had really tried to symbolize the Catholic Church as everything that was not American. So the Catholic Church was repressive, it was oppressive, it was black, it was dark, it was superstitious. And, of course, I think one of the things we have to do to keep in context, Al, is always remembering that when the colonists came over, England is going through its own Reformation at the time.
That's right.
So even though the Continental Reformation had been almost 100 years earlier, England is right in the middle of its own civil war and Reformation between the Anglicans and the Puritans. So those very people who are settling on American soil, yet their fathers, their grandfathers, grandmothers, they were all deeply involved in this Reformation struggle. So in a way that we might think, and especially I think more during the Cold War, you know, you're either for freedom or you're for communism.
Right, right.
I think at that time you were either Protestant or you were just wrong.
Yeah.
That's how they saw it.
That's right.
It was very, I think it was a very politicized religion in a lot of ways.
Now, how did the founding generation actually regard Catholicism concretely? I mean, were they there was the Quebec Act, for instance.
Right.
Tell us about that. That's what, 1774?
Yeah, that's right. And actually in July, late July of 1774, that act is passed. The Parliament actually passed that act, not thinking it had much to do with the American colonies. They were giving rights and freedoms to the Catholics in Quebec, but they were also changing land and defining the map of what, especially the area around Lake Michigan, what that would be. Would that go to the French or would that go to the English? And so the Americans got very worked up about the Quebec Act. I mean, really worked up. It was the fifth in their mind, the fifth of five intolerable acts in 1774. And it's really not accidental that, you know, it takes about 4 weeks, 5 weeks for that news of the passage of that bill to hit American shores. And within just days, they're calling for the First Continental Congress. So, yeah, it's impossible to separate the Quebec Act and allowing religious tolerance for Catholics. We can't separate that from the American founding and the Declaration, ultimately, of Independence.
So the American founding did not anticipate religious freedom for Catholics?
Yeah, that's a hard question, Al. It was so ingrained in the American colonial. So, and we shouldn't just think of it as anti-Catholic. There was also deep divisions among the various Protestants themselves.
Okay.
So almost every colony did not allow any dissent at all. So if you were living in New England, you had to be a Congregationalist, a Calvinist.
Yeah.
You couldn't be a Baptist. In fact, Baptists were actually treated worse than Catholics were, because I think Catholics were so rare in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
The same thing was true in Virginia. You had, and this was true up until 1833, you had to be a member of the Church of England, an Anglican or an Episcopalian. You couldn't be a Baptist. You couldn't be a Catholic. You couldn't be a Calvinist. And in many ways, the only thing that kind of kept the Anglicans and the Puritans from hating each other even more was that they had the common enemy of the Catholics. So it's when we go back and we look at people in the founding, even people like Thomas Jefferson, I mean, really reasonable, intelligent people, and John Adams, they allowed their own prejudices about Catholicism, very anti-Catholic, but they allowed their prejudices to supersede their reason and their study. And that I find that shocking. And yet at the same time, when you realize that Catholicism kind of just meant evil at the time,
yeah,
I can see why they did it.
What was Catholic social teaching like at the time? How did Catholicism regard republicanism?
Oh, yeah. There's been a really good book on this that came out from a professor from Marquette, Ulrich Lehr, excellent book called The Catholic Enlightenment. I don't agree with everything he writes, but only in large part because I don't know everything he's writing. Some of the stuff he's writing, I'm thinking, oh, I hadn't seen that before. But he's a great scholar, so the Catholic Enlightenment. From how I've studied it, and of course I'm only looking at it from the perspective of American Catholics, Al, not really from European Catholics. But American Catholics, and there were only a few, obviously, John Carroll, Charles Carroll were the two most prominent, and then later Daniel Carroll. But of those, there was a strong tradition within the Jesuits, and this was true in Europe too, but there was a strong tradition within the Jesuits that they tended to view the Middle Ages as Christiana Republica, as the great Christian Republic.
Okay.
And you know, they often translated the city of God to the Republic of God. And so they, the Thomists, especially the Neo-Thomists among the Jesuits, they were very favorable towards republicanism. But most of the Catholic Church was not. They tended to think of republicanism as atheism and as radicalism. So, and when the French, of course, republicans rose, that's exactly, the Catholic Church could point and say, yes, this is what we've been warning about. So they kind of assumed that the American republicans would be that bad, too.
Did they not see any continuity between the scholastic understanding of natural law and what we have in the Declaration of Independence, where it talks about nature's God and inalienable rights, that they didn't make that connection?
They did sometimes. Again, the Jesuits were best about this.
Okay.
And the Neo-Thomists, in particular Robert Bellarmine and Francisco Suarez,
yep,
Juan de Molina, these people were excellent on this. And in fact, they are so good in what they're writing. They are really challenging a lot of the idea of the divine right of monarchs. They are challenging anything really that's a kind of centralized despotism. And they were definitely making the connection between natural law, natural rights, common law, which is one reason they were so favorable towards England. They were making all those connections at the time. So, you know, Al, there's some of the best work I've seen actually has been done just on the English Reformation. Because when you have people like William Tyndale arguing for the first time in 1528 that there is a divine right of kings, we often think that's medieval. It's not medieval at all. It's early modern. Medievals would never thought that the king had a divine right.
Mm-hmm.
They thought he had a divine duty, but
right.
not a divine right. And, of course, how crazy that we associate that with medieval Catholicism.
Yes.
It's just the opposite.
That's a good
but
point.
So much of the good work that's been done on the English Reformation has shown that people like Thomas More, Erasmus, that they and John Fisher, they were really influenced by Bellarmine and Suarez. So they're actually making profound arguments about natural law, natural rights, a full century and a half before John Locke is even born. So, yeah, there's a great Catholic tradition of that, very strong. And people like Ulrich Lehr have done good work on that. At my college, Hillsdale, Matt Gaetano, Steve Smith have done really good work on that
okay.
as well.
Very good. I'm wondering here, would people like Charles Carroll of Carrollton be interested in the history of ideas, or was he, again, more of an activist than a thinker?
You know, again, a great question, and it's both for him. And I think this was true for so many of the founders, and I think one of the things that we often, you know, in 2018, we often separate the thinkers from the activists.
Right.
One of the genius aspects about the founding is that it really was the activists, well, I should say the thinkers were active, right?
Yes,
yes. You know, when you look at a John Adams, he should have just been a quiet professor somewhere. But, of course, he's our John Dickinson, right? Out
right.
there on the front lines fighting. I mean, these guys were incredible at making that happen. So I think for someone like Carroll, you know, Carroll ended up spending 17 years from age 11 on until about age 28. He was in France and England, and he ended up getting an M.A. in philosophy. He studied Plato. And he also almost got an equivalent degree in law, but really just ended up studying at the graduate level common law and civil law. But he was very much a thinker. And if you go back and look at his letters, yeah, it's impossible not to have references to Virgil and Cicero and Livy and Tacitus. But that's not unusual. That was very typical for that generation, for the founders.
Okay.
They were, you know, almost every one of the founding fathers went to college. And college for them meant going from age 14 to 17, and all they did was study Greek and Latin and a little bit of mathematics. So they were so liberally educated, I think in ways that almost seem like a foreign world to us now.
How would Charles Carroll have been regarded? I mean, here he is. He's a devout Catholic. He's brilliant, as you say. He understands ideas. He's also wealthy. I mean, he made a fortune from trading. And how would he be regarded? How could they obviously can't dismiss him.
Right.
Even in spite of his Catholicism. So what do they think? Do they think, well, he's kind of an exceptional Catholic? He's not your normal Catholic?
Al, this is some of the stuff I just loved. I mean, it just cracked up when I read. Of course, I probably wouldn't have laughed at the time, but looking back in hindsight. So Adams was, and so were Hamilton. Hamilton and Adams both just loved Carroll. They thought he was, and partly he was this fascination. They'd never met a Catholic before, and they'd never met a Catholic who blew away every one of their stereotypes. But every time Adams, and of course, of all the founders, I really love John Adams.
Yes.
He just has this terrible anti-Catholic streak. And, I mean, just beyond belief at times. Like, how could you possibly believe this? But he every time he meets Carroll, he'll write, "I just met one of the most intelligent men I have ever met, and my God, he's a papist." There's never is there not that qualifier, and he's a papist.
Brad, hold it there. We'll come back. Take a break here. My guest, Dr. Bradley Berzer, we're talking about Catholicism and the American founding. It's a fascinating story, and we'll be back and unpack more of it.
Deacon Skin and Surgeries is a comprehensive dermatology center on the border of Troy and Rochester Hills, south of M-59, and in Dearborn, west of Telegraph. Deacon Skin and Surgeries perform full skin exams and focus on the diagnosis and treatment of all types of skin cancer and precancerous lesions. All are board-certified dermatologists and fellowship-trained surgeons. Call 248-852-1900. Deacon Skin and Surgeries, a beacon for patient care. 248-852-1900.
Are you tired of investing in the culture of death? Would you like your investments to be in line with the Catholic Church? Would you like an advisor who is a fiduciary and who understands retirement issues while sharing and respecting your Catholic beliefs? Contact Joseph Vitale at American Retirement Advisors at 855-756-5700. Helping you preserve your retirement while preserving your beliefs and values. Call Joe at 855-756-5700. Beth, why is our health insurance so expensive? Our premium and deductible are so high. Plus, I don't want my family to support a company that doesn't share our values.
Kim, there is another option. Check out CMF Curo. It's an affordable Catholic healthcare ministry where members share their medical costs in community, and it's pro-life. We joined last year and have saved thousands, all without compromising our values. Just go to MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
CMF Curo sounds exactly like what our family needs.
Yeah, that's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Want better behaved kids? Here's a simple tip to instantly correct almost any inappropriate behavior. Instead of lecturing or wasting time developing increasingly strict or creative punishments, use do-overs to help your child learn to speak and act more appropriately on the spot. For instance, if your child speaks disrespectfully, insist they choose better words in a better tone and make them say it again until they express themselves well. Another example, if your child does a chore sloppily, require them to start over from the beginning as many times as necessary until they can demonstrate they know how to do the chore to your expectations. You don't need to yell. Let the do-over do the talking for you. And when they succeed, remember to compliment their effort. Good discipline teaches kids what to do instead of just telling them what not to do. For more tips to make parenting easier, check out Parenting with Grace. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Think of our Lord Jesus Christ as the physician of both our bodies and souls. Through His church, He has willed that the same healing power that forgave the paralytic his sins and empowered him to pick up his pallet and walk be transmitted to members of the church today. This takes place through the two sacraments of healing, penance and the anointing of the sick. The Catechism tells us that those who go to confession obtain God's mercy for their sins and are reconciled to God and to the church which they have wounded with their offenses. Penance is called the sacrament of conversion because in a sacramental venue it makes present Jesus' call to conversion. It is called confession because relating our offenses to a priest is an essential part of the sacrament. This is Peggy Stanton. And this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, looking at Catholicism and the American Founding with Dr. Bradley Berzer of Hillsdale College. Charles Carroll, again, one of the wealthiest Americans at the time. There's also the chief of the Miami Indians, Jean-Baptiste Richardville, who I know nothing about. What do we know about him?
Wow, I wasn't expecting you to ask that. Jean-Baptiste Richardville was, the chief of the Miamis. He was an extremely wealthy, yeah, we call him an American Indian, but he was almost certainly three-quarters French.
Okay.
And in the area, so the Miamis were centered, we often think Florida, of course, but the Miamis, the Indians at least, were centered around Chicago, Fort Wayne, and Toledo,
okay,
and Detroit. So that whole area of northern Indiana and southern Michigan. But Richardville was a devout Catholic as well, as many of the French and what they would have called Métis, or less politely, mixed blood at the time,
mm-hmm,
that these guys really did have a strong grip on they understood the geopolitics of North America. So, you know, we don't think of Fort Wayne as the center of much anymore. But I think it's a very nice small town or small city, but we don't think of it as very important. But it actually, there was an 8-mile strip of land there that connected the rivers, that connected the Great Lakes to the Mississippi and the Ohio. So if you could go down the St. Lawrence River with your goods, you could end up on the Great Lakes. You could take them to Fort Wayne all the way by water, and then you had this 8-mile portage or land that you had to take it over. And the Miami Indians under Richardville owned that land, and so they charged an immense fortune. They were making sometimes upwards of $100 a day in gold during the 1760s in order to transport goods from one ship to another and allow them then to get onto the Ohio-Mississippi River system. So, you know, who thinks of Fort Wayne that way? But it was a critical spot geographically for a very long time in American history. And Richardville, yeah, he was brilliant. He was educated, mostly French, but was also a chief, so he was able to command a lot in that region and was one of the 10 wealthiest Americans at the time of the American founding.
Did he exercise much political clout?
Yes, among the Indians, and he did in the West because he controlled that portage. He was able to kind of balance French interests, Spanish interests, British, and American interests in that region. And there's been some good work on this. This tends to happen in a lot of borderlands where you have various cultures meeting at one point.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find someone that's sometimes, at least in academia, I'm not sure how great of a term this is, but in academia they're called cultural brokers.
Okay.
And they almost always, you know, do well out of this. And
yes.
Richardville, you know, one of the other things he did that I find fascinating, Al, is when the Americans were forcing the Indians to remove to the West, what he did was rather than sign the treaty for the Miamis as a tribe, they signed it as individual property owners. So by doing that, the land actually became the property of each individual Miami, and they weren't forced to remove because they became property owners rather than little nations. So a kind of interesting alternative to the removal that we saw in that time period.
Oh, that's fascinating. I was unaware of that. That's certainly an option.
Yeah, they weren't the only ones to do it. Yeah, it didn't happen often. It wasn't the kind of thing the Americans offered, but Richardville was so staunch about this, and he had the money in the pool that he could get away with it. A few of the Potawatomis did that as well. It was mostly those tribes that had usually the highest amount of French blood typically understood the market best and tried to do that.
Okay.
So, pretty interesting story.
Yeah, really. Now, what do we know what percentage of the colonists were Catholic? Is there any reliable number?
Oh, so when we're back in the 13 colonies, the percentage would be, you know, less than 1%.
Yeah,
okay. So we're really only talking in the 13 colonies prior to the Revolution. We're really only talking about the Irish, and they were wealthy Irish generally, that had settled, like Carroll, that had settled in under Lord Baltimore, had settled in Maryland. You're going to find all kinds of Catholics in places like St. Louis and New Orleans and Detroit, but that's because they're French cities,
right,
and they're not,
right,
of course, properly a part of the 13 colonies yet.
Yeah, and I mean,
so it's a very small percentage.
And do you know off the top of your head when there was actually the first establishment of a diocese or an archdiocese?
Well, so the first archbishop is John Carroll, and that's in the 1790s.
Okay.
And I think the second one, Alan, someone could correct me, I think the second one is in Kentucky, right? So
you've near Bardstown. Yeah, the St. Joseph Proto-Cathedral there, yeah. Bardstown,
exactly.
Kentucky.
So it divides the original 13 under one bishop, and then the new colonies, the new states under another bishop.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was just rereading Death Comes for the Archbishop. I mean, Catherine, of course, there you've got the establishment of a new one out in New Mexico, right?
And was that Lammy?
Bardstown, Dianese, in real life, right? Latour in the novel.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, great stuff. I love that.
When do the American elites decide that the influx of Catholics becomes something that has to be addressed, that it becomes recognized as
right.
a threat. They were anti-Catholic before, but if the population is under 1%, it's not, you know, you're not that worried about it, I would think.
Exactly.
When is there political reaction to Catholics?
Right. So you're not going to find much of that. And, you know, when you get into the Second Great Awakening, it's really, which it starts around 1800, 1801, mm-hmm. huge evangelical revival. That distracts everybody from any Catholic problems because you essentially have Protestants fighting Protestants and the divisions. I mean, you also have a great growth in evangelicalism,
yes.
but along the way you get this denominational infighting that's just brutal for about 40 years. And it's during that time that the Americans are really, the Protestants are fighting amongst themselves, that Catholics start coming. So it's mostly to Boston and New England where Irish workers are coming. And these are typical Irish who, you know, they're poor working class who will come over, work for a while, and then head back to Ireland.
Mm.
So you don't have a lot of permanent settlement. So throughout the 1830s, you have some. But really, the great influx of Catholics doesn't come until 1846, 47, and 48. You have almost no major immigration to the United States between the American founding and 1846.
So this is at the end. This is at the very end of the Second Great Awakening.
That's right. No, absolutely. Huh. And, of course, then you have Irish, and you have Catholics, and you have Lutherans. And I realize we don't consider Lutherans Catholic, but from the 19th century perspective, Lutherans were generally considered as kind of a Catholic light.
Oh, okay.
So there was no love for the Lutherans among most Protestants. They were still seen as very strange.
Wow.
Not as bad as Catholics, but pretty close. so we can, for purposes of bigotry, we can kind of lump them together in the 1840s.
All right.
So the Scandinavians were seen as weird as the Bavarians when they're coming over. But really, I mean, the amazing thing to me, Al, is that yeah, we really don't have major immigration to the United States between 1776 and 1846. We have a massive population growth, but that's almost all just procreation among young couples having lots and lots of children, more than the world has ever seen before since.
Catholics?
It was astounding. No, everybody.
Everybody, okay.
Just Americans. Yeah, black and white. You look at the... Actually, on the frontier, Al, and every time I say this, I can see my female students groan, but the average woman on the frontier, not in the city, but in the frontier in the early 19th century was having 13 live births.
Oh, mercy.
The Americans were calling this the American multiplication table. So we didn't need immigrants because, We're just having kids.
It's
unbelievable. Yeah.
We just had our 13th grandchild last night, in fact.
Oh, very nice.
But it took three women to do that.
That's right. Well, Hillsdale's a little odd, right? My provost has 11. Yeah, we have 7. we're this little pocket of creation.
No, that's good.
Yeah, no, congratulations, Al. That's wonderful.
Thanks. Once the immigration begins, there's in popular culture, there are all kinds of rumors that go around, and this woman, Maria Monk, is frequently discussed.
Maria Monk, yes.
These stories are so wild that you wonder how they were found believable. Tell me what you know about Maria Monk.
Sure. Well, so Maria Monk, I mean, this is really, basically, it's soft pornography. Maria Monk was and there was a real Maria Monk, but supposedly that she was this woman who had been a good Protestant who had been taken in and had become a nun. And once she became a nun, she found that the real rituals of the Catholic Church, everything from cannibalism, all this was true. They were then, she was, they, she found out that the nuns were to have children with the priests and sacrifice these babies. This is actually, what we now call, I'm going to be careful about this, Al. Let's just say one of the major 5 publishers in America today got its start by publishing these stories in the 1840s and 50s and making tons of money. This is really, I don't want to get you or me in trouble.
But they were popular. They were that popular.
Oh, yeah, but popular in the way that maybe in the way in the 1970s someone may have walked into a quick shop and bought a Playboy. It's that they were popular in the sense, you know, everybody bought them, but nobody talked about them. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Okay.
If that makes sense, though.
Yeah.
I was too young in the 70s to have done that, but you know what I mean. Hopefully you know what I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm just trying. I'm trying to
huge influence.
Reconstruct it, because you also had elites like Lyman Beecher, who was an extraordinary. I mean, again, I thought father of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who had this book Plea for the West, I think it was, which he feared that the Pope himself would set up shop in the Ohio Valley. I think. I'm trying to remember.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, there was this great fear that the French would come back and they would be the army of the Pope and they would reclaim Louisiana and, of course, the whole territory of St. Louis all the way up to Detroit. Yeah, they're worried about that. So, yeah, that – and, of course, there's nothing even remotely possible in any of that. But it was Lyman Beecher who gave that infamous homily or sermon in the early 1830s in which he said, you know, there are true Republican men, good men here. In Boston, we will not allow this nunnery to be standing by tomorrow night.
Ouch.
And, yeah, and they burned the nunnery.
They burned, that's the Ursuline.
Yes, right. I mean, this is Beecher, the ultimate demagogue.
Wow.
Yeah, so crazy.
Well, Brad, thanks so much. Great talking with you.
Oh, Al, it's great talking to you.
Wonderful tough story.
Not necessarily the happiest stuff.
Well, it's important to know. It's important to know.
That's right.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Al. Great talking to you as always.
Dr. Bradley Berzer, Catholicism and the American Founding.
Are you tired of investing in the culture of death? Would you like your investments to be in line with the Catholic Church? Would you like an advisor who is a fiduciary and who understands retirement issues while sharing and respecting your Catholic beliefs? Contact Joseph Vitale at American Retirement Advisors at 855-756-5700. Helping you preserve your retirement while preserving your beliefs and values. Call Joe at 855-756-5700.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shield.
Ask the Lord today, show me what I could do to at least greatly reduce the temptation to this sin, or maybe by God's grace, eliminate it. Because it's sin, brothers and sisters, that darkens our intellect and weakens our will. That's the catechism. And we don't understand that because we're in such a sinful condition that we don't recognize how little we're seeing and how little we're hearing. We're blind and we're deaf because of sin. So what we want to do is get free of that. And sometimes it takes a year or more to conquer a sin, especially when there's a habit or a pattern of sin. Might be drugs, might be alcohol, might be sex. Just be honest with God. But we make a decision now, Lord, I want to get on that path. Help me to overcome this sin. And then ask Him, show me what the vulnerability is in me that makes me fall into that sin. That I might be able to follow you more clearly, that you might be able to use me to help others. That's what a good Christian really wants. You want the Lord to be able to use you.
Sister Ann Shields gives you food for the journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 11:30 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Crest in the Afternoon. Once again, my name is Bryant Shanley, Al's executive producer. Hoping you enjoyed our discussions in that hour with Dr. Greg Popchek, looking at the effects of cohabitation. We'll be talking again with him sometime next week. There's some new research being done on the effects of people who leave the church. We have always heard that, you know, kids who are raised in the church do better socially in a lot of different ways. That there are a lot of very positive social science effects of religion. But in the wake of all of the mess the church is going through right now, a lot of people are just throwing up their hands and saying, I'm done with this. I'm going to go spend my life somewhere else. And what is the effect that has on their kids, kids who are raised initially in the church and then leave? We'll be talking about that again sometime next week with Dr. Greg Popchuk, who is at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Speaking of Steubenville, as I said earlier this week, I will be down there the last weekend in July for the Defending the Faith Conference, where he will be speaking. This is where we met Leah Darrow last year. I'm not sure if she's going to be back, but there's going to be lots of other great speakers there this year. So if you're able to check that out, we'll have that linked at the website in the Cresta Guest Archive, as well as articles by Brad Berzer. Again, he is the Russell Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College and the author of several books, including Russell Kirk, American Conservative. He has been writing just about every year. He publishes an article on Catholics in the early days of America and the contributions Catholics made in that time. And so we'll be all those articles will be available in the Cresta Guest Archive. Now, coming up in the next hour is a very, very well-respected author on the Mass. This is Abbot Jeremy Driscoll, who has written a book called What Happens at Mass. Has been very well-received by people like Scott Hahn, Father John Ricardo, good friends of ours, who have highly, highly recommended it. And Abbot Driscoll was in town about a little over a year ago. It was last spring. And Al sat down with him and recorded a long conversation that we split into a portion on the Liturgy of the Word and the Introductory Rite, and then the Liturgy of the Eucharist. And we have shared those in the past. We shared the Liturgy of the Eucharist segment during Holy Week as we prepared for Holy Thursday. Coming up in the next hour, Abbot Jeremy Driscoll, what happens during the Liturgy of the Word. Stay tuned.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.